Good morning. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 19th, in the year 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Michael Palette. Today's session number is POM 2001-04, and it's entitled Call Waiting. Don't miss that important call. Let's listen in to Michael and his class.
A minute or two, but I just want to check, does everyone have a Bible? Close to a Bible, if you need some, we can. Who needs a Bible? Are we all okay?
Thank you.
All right, then if we have Bibles, let me cue the tape ministry, media ministry, that we're ready to begin. So good morning.
Good morning.
And I don't know if I need to introduce myself. I've been in John's Gospel so long that my temptation is, have I been with you so long that you do not know me? Anyway. Not to be pretentious. I'm Michael Pellet, and I am a pastor at a Lutheran church in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and I'm also a professor in religious studies and philosophy at the University of Saskatchewan. So I keep busy. This week we have been looking at John chapters 13 through 17, what's talked about or known as Jesus' farewell discourse. And what I'm looking at this week and focusing on the theme here at Holden for this summer, I have called you by name, is that sense of Jesus calling the disciples, calling us into community. And that if you have been here for other sessions, you know that we've paid attention to little words like you, and find out that in John's Gospel, you, Y-O-U, is always, or most of the time, in the plural, not the singular. So that John or Jesus isn't just talking about what all of this means at an individualistic level, but the understanding that the exercise of Christian faith, of Christian love, indeed, of being Christian, of being a disciple, is to be in community. It is in community, as a disciple community, where God works, where the word is at work, being spoken and heard and enacted. And so we've been looking at this section of John's Gospel from that perspective of how Jesus is calling us into community and what that means. And we began with the foot washing, again, as Jesus pouring out his life for us as a symbol of loving one another, and how that continued on. We see how that goes on in the next part of chapter 13 with the discussion and debate between Jesus and Judas, and how Jesus shows loving to the end, and even amidst that which is diabolical, divisive, alienating, conflictual in our midst. Yesterday we continued to look at that as Jesus says, I will be going soon. And everybody, particularly Peter again, thought, well, that's bad news. If you go, that's really going to be hard on the community. And Jesus says, no, actually going is going to build and help community. And we looked very carefully yesterday at chapter 14, verse 2. In my Father's house there are many dwelling places. And again, how that word dwelling place does not mean, as we sometimes understood, you know, mansion, you know, like the big 37-room house in the sky, but that really dwelling place is talking about a rest stop for travelers on the way. If you heard Matins this morning, right, you saw the many of the themes here are again brought out by that reading that was done from Eugene Peterson, that disciples and pilgrims go together, because after all, if as Christians we are pilgrims on the way, every now and then we need an overnight camping ground, a rest stop, or if we're kind of fancy, a bed and breakfast. And so what Jesus is saying here is that in my Father's house there are many bed and breakfasts. And those bed and breakfasts, again, are not up there in heaven, but down here. Because you see, the sense of what Jesus is getting at in terms of I go to prepare a place for you, those places are for us here as travelers. Right? Jesus does not have to get a group of mavericks to go up and remodel heaven, like the mavericks and folks here had to do in remodeling Agape or any of these, right? Heaven is built, heaven is made, heaven is done. Heaven is not the problem. Not the problem for Jesus or for us, if you will. That's the done deal. The issue is, what are we doing here? What helps us for our journey and our life here? This is where we need places. And so Jesus is going to prepare these places for us. Now that, you know, that might sound new and different and said, boy, nobody's talked about the text that way before. That's a really different way of talking about it. And perhaps it is. I mean, I don't know the way in which you've always looked at these passages. But it's not anything new in the sense that has been a very traditional way of interpreting and understanding this passage within the whole history of the church. And I want to give just one example of this, because again, I think if I haven't been able to say it clearly, maybe St. Augustine can. And St. Augustine has many, many sermons on John's Gospel. And in one of his sermons on John chapter 14, and on this verse we were looking at, verse 2, let me read you just one sentence from him, because I think, again, it gets at very succinctly what I'm trying to say when Jesus says, in my Father's house there are many dwelling places, I go to prepare a place for you. Augustine says, quote unquote, Jesus prepares the dwelling places by preparing those who are to dwell in them. Get that? Jesus prepares the dwelling places by preparing those who are to dwell in them. And again, isn't that what he's doing right here with the disciples, right? He's not going up there saying, build heaven. He's saying, I have to build these disciples. I have to prepare these disciples. I have to prepare this community. My way of putting that or paraphrasing that is, again, Jesus prepares the disciple community by preparing disciples for community. And so that's why, again, these discourses are calling us into community. They are preparing us to be the community, to be Christ's community here. That's the dwelling places that Jesus is preparing. Right? So if you will, if Jesus is doing any work, but the work that Jesus is doing is on us. We're the ones on whom Jesus is working. And today, as we continue on in chapter 14, to see, we'll see how Jesus is preparing us for community. How does that work? And so I've put the little outline on the board in terms of where we're trying to go. The rest of chapter 14, kind of two key sections. Jesus is going to prepare us for community, for being disciples, through the unifying power of love. And how that will always work again is we've got our key word, dwelling. There will be the dwelling of the Paraclete, the dwelling of Jesus himself, the dwelling of the Father and Jesus. And again, our little word play, chapter 14, verse 2, in my Father's house there are many dwelling places. That was that manai. That's the dwelling place. That's where. And here when we get, when Jesus says, like, the Paraclete dwells with you, it's this, it's the verb mene. So in other words, Jesus or John is always using the same word, sometimes in its form as a noun, sometimes in its form as a verb. But, you know, you get that sense, you know, John is, it's a motif. He's got a word and he's using it and using it and using it. We don't catch that in our English translation because these words can be translated as dwelling, abiding, remaining, and staying. And so chances are in this section in John's Gospel, if you run across dwell, abide, remain, or stay in any of its forms, it's the same Greek word. John's using the same word in all of its nuances. Right. So that's that dwelling side. The other thing about how does Jesus prepare us to be the disciple community? It's through the gift of peace. And thankfully we have Tara on teaching staff this week so that if I don't get to all this stuff about peace, you have five sessions that talk about peace and peacemaking and what that all entails and how we as the disciple community are engaged, given that gift of peace, we share that peace and make that peace with others. So that's just my way of saying I feel some of the pressure is off me, thanks to Tara, because this particular section she is admirably covering, right? This is happening for us, but I hope we have a little time to get to that. So that's kind of the outline of where we're going. So let's get into chapter 14, starting right at verse 15. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. And so we're starting out again right with that motif, that theme of love. And Jesus is switching it from where he had just finished in verse 14. Okay, we should bring that in. Jesus says, if in my name you ask me for anything, I will do it. And then if you love me, you will keep my commandments. What we see here again is a mutual sense of loving. I think the claim Jesus is making here is saying, Jesus loves them, so he will do what they ask, and if they love Jesus, they will do what he asks. Right. Think about any close, mutual, loving relationship, whether that might be a marriage, or parents and children, or good friends, or that. I mean, if you truly love one another, you are not going to ask stupid things of one another. It's the sense here that Jesus loves us, we love Jesus. What does this mean in terms of, again, asking in Jesus' name or a sense of prayer? Well, it means we're not going to say, dear Jesus, help me win the lottery. Because that wouldn't be, if there's a sense of love, that would not be a loving request. There's a difference between asking out of love and asking for our own desires. I might desire a lot of things, but that's not necessarily the same as love. And so here again, you could say, well, when Jesus says, if you ask anything in my name, I'll give it to you. Well, but the thing again, if there is that sense of love, what are you going to ask for? That, if you will, that puts the check on what we ask. Because again, in a loving relationship, you don't ask for things which are harmful, hurtful, divisive of that relationship. That would be, right? That's the way of the world. The world might do that, but not the disciple community. And again, whatever it is that we might ask, the key gift, the most important gift that Jesus gives us is the Paraclete. Right? That's where we go next. And I will ask the Father, and he will give you another advocate to be with you forever. So first, let's look a little bit at this notion of Paraclete. Parakletos in Greek, it's a translation of a Hebrew word, and that Hebrew word means to comfort. So again, if you remember the King James Version, when it's there, you know, I will send you the Comforter. That again is a more kind of Hebrew understanding of Paraclete. But of course, the Comforter is not just simply a warm, snuggly quilt. So we have to ask still, what does it mean to comfort? And I want to present you with one passage where we get this sense of comfort in Hebrew, a passage with which I'm sure many of you are familiar. It's Psalm 23, Psalm 23, verse 4. And that reads, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Now, you know, you think about that isn't that a rod and staff comfort you? You know, what happened? You know, there's the shepherd, he's got his crook, and there's the, you know, you're the sheep, and they go, whack, whack, hoo-hoo, boy, that was comforting. What does that mean? Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Now, I know you've all heard the 23rd Psalm, so you're the experts on this. What does that mean? What do we mean there by comfort? Please, tell me.
Guidance.
Protection.
Guidance.
Protection.
Discipline.
That's kind of interesting. As we talk about disciples and discipline, there might be something.
Saving. I think of the book as kind of
saving.
You know, rescuing.
Rescuing.
Well, you have the sense of security that you have a shepherd. You know.
Okay, a sense of security. With comforting.
Shepherd uses staff also to guide his flock.
Guiding. Yeah. Providing that direction. Anything else?
Knows more than I know.
Or no.
I'm sorry, I just didn't hear you.
Knows more than I know.
Knows more than I do.
To ward off.
To ward off, yeah. Guarding, protecting, yeah.
If we go astray, he brings us back.
Brings us back. So have you all found comfort in those meanings?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. No, I think that's right. That's the whole realm of what we're talking about here. It's all of those things. Maybe the one thing I would add is that, you know, the word comfort itself literally comes from two little Latin words, cum and forte. And cum means with, and fort means strength, right? So that to comfort someone is to strengthen them or to make them strong. And of course, all of the things you suggested, guarding, guiding, protecting, rescuing, right? Those are all various facets that we can employ to make someone strong. And so that's who the Paraclete is. The Paraclete is the one that comes to the disciple community to strengthen it. And, right, goodness knows this disciple community needs a little strengthening, because remember the context. Jesus has just told them, there's a betrayer in your midst, and they don't know who it is. And Jesus has also told them, I'm leaving. And they're not real happy about that. And so in the midst of those, you know, kind of two, what they think are two terrible announcements, here for the first time is at least a little good news. Hey, there's someone coming who will strengthen you. Finally, some good news. Another meaning of the word comfort, and I think John is using both of these. This is the word paraclete. In Hebrew, it has with it this understanding of comfort. It's a word that's also used in Greek within a legal context, and it would be translated, as the New Revised Standard Version has it there, as advocate. And here, the paraclete, the advocate, is the one who helps you in court. Right. The one who, again, advocate, who speaks for you in court. Our way of talking about it is, it's your attorney. And if we think about this in the context of John's gospel, and remember with the betrayer in our midst and the diabolical one, Satan, and if you were here, you remember that literally Satan means what?
Accuser.
Accuser. Well, so my goodness, if all of a sudden we've been accused, what do we need? An attorney. We need a lawyer. And the good news here again is Jesus says, I'm sending you an attorney. In that verse as well, we read, right, that what the Father is sending us is, he will give you another advocate. Well, that little adjective there, another, implies that at least this must be the second advocate. Well, who was the first advocate?
Jesus himself.
Because isn't this what Jesus has been doing all along, right? Strengthening and speaking for the community of disciples. And so, right, here again, the good news, not only are we being sent an attorney, but it's another attorney. I mean, woohoo, we've got a team of lawyers here, right? I mean, this is great, because, you know, the accuser is great as well. So, you know, it's nice to know that we've got a legal team working for us. And that legal team to be with you forever. This with you forever, and right, no retainer fee. Right, just think about this. A team of attorneys working for you constantly with no retainer necessary. Now, this is good news, right? Finally, you would say, all the good news that a community needs to continue on, right? You see how Jesus is now preparing this community by sending us the Paraclete. And again, Jesus says in the last half of verse 17, you know him because he abides with you. Now that word abides, that's our little Greek word there for dwells. You could also translate that again, that the Paraclete dwells with you and he will be in you. And again, those yous there, that word you is always plural. There's the plural sense of all of this. We move into verse 18. Again, words of assurance. I will not leave you orphaned, because that's again what the disciples have been afraid of. If we go back to that discussion with Peter and Thomas and Philip, Peter wanted to say, oh, you know, Jesus, I want to follow you. Don't leave me alone. And Thomas says, well, you know, show us the way, because we don't want to be without you. And if you have to go, well, at least tell us how to get there. And Philip said, well, you know, if you're going to go, at least show us the Father. You know, give us somebody else to be here. They're always worried about loss. And Jesus says, I'm not going to leave you orphaned. I'm going to come to you. But in a way that, again, is unexpected. Verse 20, on that day, you will know that I am in my Father, and you in me, and I in you. Right, there's again that sense of dwelling, only now it's that synonymous phrase of being in. Right. Being in the Father, right. I in you, you in me. But it's that whole theme here again of dwelling. And so we keep that sense of dwelling, right? Now here, the Paraclete and Jesus are in the community. Verse 22, Judas, but not Iscariot, a different Judas, again, right? A very minor disciple, but again, how John helps to show the diversity of disciples. Judas asks the question, Lord, how is it that you will reveal yourself to us and not to the world? And so here again we have Judas, who John is using as a foil, who asks a question, and in some sense a good question, but the wrong question, because again it's two different levels. Judas's question is basically, well, Jesus, how is it that we will be able to see you, but the world can't see you? Again, Judas seems to be thinking about seeing as physical sight. I mean, wouldn't it be kind of foolish to say, well, you know, after this, all of you who are here in Bible study, for the rest of the day, you will be able to see me, but the world out there will not be able to see me. And you go, oh, yeah, well, there's another fantasy. Because, well, yeah, you can see me as easily inside this room as outside this room, right? The physical appearance is going to be there. But, of course, that's not Jesus' point. It has nothing to do with physical sight. Here again, for John, the sense of seeing is a sense of recognition, a sense of insight, a sense of understanding. And at that point, we could say, well, there Judas really doesn't have a bad question, does he? How is it that we as the disciple community have these insights, but the other folks out there do not? And of course, as we'll see, Jesus' answer to that is, well, because of the work of love, God's work of love, the Paraclete's work of love, in you and among you. So that in that sense, you have insight and you see things differently than the world sees them. And here in chapter 14, that different way of seeing things will be seen in terms of that gift of peace. We're going to see things differently. Verse 23, Jesus' response there. He says, those who love me will keep my word. That those who love me, it's a very, very broad way of responding there. It's kind of like whoever loves me. It's an open kind of thing, right? Judas, again, only asked in terms of us, right? How is it that we see, or how is it that you're revealed to us? And Jesus comes back with whoever. I think the sense here in John is saying, you know, let's not get into the us, them, the we, they mentality. As much as John emphasizes the sense of community and the kind of community he wants to build, even with all of that, he recognizes that the notions of community, the notions of relationship to God, are always broader than the boundaries that we want to set. On the one hand, John thinks his way of being community, the way of setting up the Johannine church and Johannine community, is the right way, is the best way. But if you will, it's not the only way. There is that recognition there. There are other ways of being community. Because the criterion, again, is always one of love. And so wherever love is at work, there we have the sense of community. A different place, you know, why do some people see you? Why don't they see you? How does that work? Back in John's gospel, earlier in a situation, an incident, if you would turn to John chapter 7, verses 1 through 10, please. And if someone gets there, if they would just be willing to read that for us. And just to show that again, as this is one of the themes of John's gospel. Chapter 7, verses 1 through 10.
After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He did not wish to go about in Judea because the Jews were looking for an opportunity to kill him. Now the Jewish festival of booths was near, so his brothers said to him, leave here and go to Judea so that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one who wants to be widely known acts in secret. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. For not even his brothers believed in him. Jesus said to them, my time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify against it that its works are evil. Go to the festival yourselves. I'm not going to this festival, for my time has not yet fully come. After saying this, he remained in Galilee. But after his brothers had gone to the festival, then he also went, not publicly, but as it were, in secret.
Okay, thank you. Right. Typical Johannine way of talking, right? No, I'm not going to go. They won't understand. I'm staying behind. So he went anyway, but in secret. And again, part of that, you know, what's happening here again is that sense of insight. Jesus is doing what he's doing, right? not to make a big splash. You know, the sense here about why his brothers are not believing in him. Because, you know, they're saying, well, you know, Jesus, if what you say is true and if all of this works, well, then why don't you go up to Jerusalem and, you know, why don't you, you know, rent out Jerusalem Stadium and pack it with 100,000 people and have the big hoopla show? You know, make a big splash, make a big deal. You know, the greatest revival that Jerusalem and Judea have ever seen. And he goes, no, that's not how it works. Here again, in the sense of the command to love one another. Loving one another is not making a big splash. The insight there is that way of loving one another is often quietly, gently, obscurely done. That's how the Christian community practices that. Or another case, I mean, another way I see this within our own context. It's the phrase within liberation theology, that phrase, God's preferential option for the poor. And a lot of folks, particularly in North America, don't like that because we say, well, that seems to be that God likes the poor better than God likes us. Well, that may be true, but that's not what it means. The preferential option for the poor is a way of saying what? Among the poor is where love is needed. And if love happens there, that's where God is. It's not that God likes them better than anyone else, or that the poor are better than anyone else, because that, I mean, we're not making those kinds of, you know, moral or economic or whatever comparisons. It's the sense that you can see that among the poor is provided for all of us as disciple communities the deepest opportunity for practicing love. And if you see that, right, if you have that insight, then, right, you are liberated, or in John's, you know, gospel, then you have seen the truth, and the truth has made you free, right? That insight, that freedom to love. If you don't see that, you're still walking around with your blinders on. You're missing all of those opportunities for love. And again, that love is not mere charity. Right, somewhat up here, handing down. But again, remember that sense of love is mutual. Right? Loving one another. The poor minister to us as much as we minister to them. Right? That's the kind of insight, I think, that our liberation theologian friends give us and help us to see about this dynamic of loving one another and not breaking that down into an us-them kind of mentality. Okay, from here, that sense again of making our dwelling verse 23, about those who love me will keep my word, and my Father will love them, and we will come to them and make our home with them. That phrase, make our home, is again our favorite Greek word, dwell. It's another way, it's a fine translation, it's another way of saying that, but it's here again, this is the notion of dwelling. The flip side of that, verse 24, the first half, whoever does not love me does not keep my words. And the word that you, well, let me stop there. Whoever does not love me does not keep my words. This is the way in which, again, we discern the disciple community from the world. On the one hand, right, a very simple criterion and yet very hard to discern. Are we a loving community? Who is a loving community? And the thing there again, it's not a secret, because again, loving one another would have a visibility to it. There would be a witness to it. So again, the kind of question would be, what do our communities witness? We can go back again kind of to the law court model of advocate. Right? when the advocate comes, when the paraclete comes to say, well, okay, now you know you've been accused. We've got to make a case. We need some evidence. Have you got any evidence? Well, what's your evidence, right? Disciple community, what's your evidence for showing love one another? So again, this can indict us for our lovelessness, or it can commend us for our loving one another. That's the sense there. Okay, moving on into the sense of peace and the, well, no, let me talk a little bit here about the paraclete, what's going to happen here in verses 25 and 26, right? The paraclete, the verse 26, the paraclete, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, will teach you everything or all things, and remind you of all things that I have said to you. Okay, so that what we have here, I think, are two parallel phrases. Teach you all things and remind you of all things is trying to mean the same thing, right? Those are two different ways of saying the same thing. What's trying to be said here is that, again, it's not that the paraclete is going to add anything quantitatively new, right? It's not to say, well, Jesus is saying, well, I'm only here a short time, so I can only get two-thirds of the way through the book, and then the Spirit will come and give you the other third. But it's rather the sense that in teaching us and reminding us, the Spirit unfolds the meaning. We get the full meaning. In other words, again, we see here that the disciples are lacking insight, right? They don't get it. And so the thing is, well, when will they get it? Or who will help them get it? That's the paraclete. We have that sense, too, when we say the Spirit is at work in our midst. How is the Spirit at work in our midst? By helping to, again, unfold the meaning of Jesus' life, of what the Scriptures say as they witness to him. Right? I mean, we have that... Why do we preach on the same texts year after year after year? Basically because clergy are malicious and we're trying to bore you to death, right? Or the other way of saying that is, well, you're so stupid you didn't get it the first time, so we'll do it again and again and again. Both of those are the wrong answers, right? The sense there is that every time we reflect on those passages, we study those passages, we get into the Word, new insights unfold. New understandings come to the fore. That's the work of the Spirit as the teacher and the reminder. And again, right, that happens in community. That happens in the to and fro discussion and conversation among ourselves and so on. So that's what's meant here. It's not in the sense that anything quantitatively new, but it's that unfolding of meaning. Because what? The situations within the communities change. Our disciple communities don't face the same situations that Jesus' first century communities face. And so on. And so it's the work of the Spirit there to lead us into that. From there, now let's go to a little bit yet to the gift of peace, or Hebrew word there of shalom. Okay. Shalom, and again, Tara has sessions on this, and I'm going to spend minutes on it. Shalom within the Hebrew context, to summarize that in one word, has a notion of wholeness. There is a sense of wholeness, so that there is a wholeness with ourself, with our neighbor, with creation, with God. In one sense, the creation stories of Genesis 1 and 2 give us a picture of shalom, of the wholeness and harmony of all creation. And of course, Genesis 3 demonstrates how human beings disintegrated that shalom, right? The wholeness was fragmented, broken, right? There's the diabolic coming in, if we want to use John's picture here. And so that's what Jesus is saying. But even more, verse 27, peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Okay, let's think about that one a little bit. Jesus seems to be suggesting as well that the world at least proposes to give some kind of peace. So what would be the difference between Jesus' peace and the world's peace?
The world's peace might be something like financial security, and Jesus' peace is security in Him.
Okay. What would be the difference between financial security and security in Jesus?
Just to push. Financial security you can't actually count on forever, because that can change quite dramatically, quite quickly. Jesus is always there. He said, "I'm going to leave you."
Okay.
Money can leave you.
Okay. So there's a sense of dependency and reliability, on the one hand, over against who knows, on the other. All right. What else between Jesus' peace and the world's peace? Because after all, as a disciple community who's got the Paraclete, both comforter and advocate, working for you, you should be able to kind of see some of these things. So this is kind of quiz time. Yes, please.
I would think that peace that Christ gives is given freely without us. He doesn't require payment for it. When the world peace comes, you're taxed and you're responsible for it.
Okay, so let me try and get some of these things down. He said that the peace of Christ was reliable. You're saying that it is
free.
We'll use it even bigger. Unconditional.
Right.
And then we've got a, we don't need this anymore. We'll talk about, in quotation marks, world peace. And instead of reliable, we'll say it is insecure. And instead of unconditional, we'll just say there are strings attached. How's that? Okay.
It usually depends on our doing something.
Mm-hmm. Over here?
Yeah, I'm just thinking even realistically of countries negotiating and whatnot. Depends on both sides agreeing, depends on... it depends on compromise. Is that, yeah.
That was okay. And what's the, you know, here there's doing something. What would be the contrast with the peace of Christ?
Gift.
Okay, that sounds pretty good. What about compromise? What's over here?
It's been accomplished.
It's completed. It's eternal.
It's fully.
I think the peace of Christ will last, and the world peace might fade away.
Okay. Or I'm just gonna try this one out for size, maybe. Instead of compromise, let's just say promise. Mm-hmm. Right. But a promise on which you don't renege.
Right.
Again, back to the notion like a reliable promise. Right. You can count on it, you can depend on it, it's reliable. As rather than a compromise, well, maybe there's going to be some shifting there or something.
It depends on both sides keeping the bargain with compromise, yeah. And the other,
yeah.
Other one is doesn't depend on.
So this is again, this is a kind of contract thing, but a promise is not a contract. Yes, please.
I don't have the whole idea, but under world peace, there's a certain part you have to defend.
I did.
You have to defend.
Okay.
On the world peace, but I don't know the other half of it. Yeah.
Okay, well, the nice thing is we're community, see? So as disciple community, you don't have to do this all alone. They're going to help you out. What's the other half of defend? What would, if we have to defend this piece over here, what would be the other side?
Accept.
It's done.
Security.
Accept, security.
We give it freely.
We give it, yeah. I think that's... We give, or maybe we want to be so bold here as to say we love. I mean, this is a kind of, you have to be very defensive about this. Christ's peace is a peace that we give, just as you know.
And we receive it.
And we receive it. And so, okay. I'll just put it here. Receive, give, love. Right, they're all, again, they kind of work together. But it's that sense we don't have to defend it.
World peace is temporary.
Temporary? All right. And this is?
Permanent.
Or again, if we want to talk about John's way of saying it, we would say it's like this is his term again of everlasting life, isn't it? And again, that already starts here. We're living in that peace of Christ, sharing that peace of Christ. I mean, right? Every Eucharistic service is we share the peace of Christ with one another. And note again, right? That's a community action. You really can't do it to yourself, right? I mean, at least so far in my observing, usually when we share the peace, no one goes, the peace of Christ be to me too, right? It's got to go out somewhere, right? You shake someone else's hand. You embrace someone else. And so that's that receiving, giving, and again, a testimony about how we are all living in that life.
What you're just alluding to with the community part of it, on a more personal level, you know, the world's idea of peace is kind of like the absence, or maybe a person's idea of being at peace would be the absence of having trouble or strife or whatever.
Yep.
Whereas with Christ, you can have the peace of God, you know, in yourself personally, and be at peace in the middle of trouble, when there is trouble.
Mm-hmm. So this we think of peace as always the absence of conflict, and this could be all right.
Transcends.
You're pushing me here. I'm going to try this one.
Transcends conflict.
Transcend, or I'm going to try the word, as we've talked about it before, that it's comfort in conflict.
Yes.
Right, that even though we're in a struggle, we're still at peace, we are still comforted, we're still strengthened, right? There's our friend now, the paraclete, as comforter, saying, yeah, I mean, everybody's out to get you, but what? Peace. You are still strengthened because you know that in Christ, this kind of conflict is not what it's all about. That's not the true reality. Anything else about peace? Yes.
I put peace of Christ is rest, in the sense of our hearts are restless until they rest in thee.
Mm-hmm. Thank you,
Augustine. So that deepest need. And then the world's peace is restless, because we're always we're always needing to figure out how to gain our own significance.
Yeah.
Or make our own significance.
That restless, because, you know, there's always more, and a sense of rest. Okay. Anything else?
About political. World peace is political.
Mm-hmm.
And peace of Christ is equal.
It is?
Equal.
Equal? Okay. What do you mean by equal?
It is for everyone, and it's
Okay, so here, political means that it's some, there's some have it, some don't, there's winners and losers,
right.
And equal means that it is for all.
Correct.
Yes, I think that's a very important point, in the sense of, again, the way the world has peace is always, I mean, usually, how does the world get peace?
Right.
Through war, right? You know. If you folks can't get along, I'm just going to have to knock a few heads. Right? Isn't it, again, ironic that the world's way of getting peace is usually through killing somebody, subjugating somebody, repressing somebody, violent ways? And that always means, right, it's going to be winners and losers. If I want to be at peace so that I can eat as much as I want, I'm going to have to get rid of some of you so there's going to be more for me. And then, there's peace. Yeah, well, for me there's peace, but not for all of you losers who are out there starving to death. Right? That I think here again, let me just put it this way. The world's way of peace, again, and this is so diabolical, isn't it? The world's way of peace is always one of violence. It's war and all. And again, since it's the big theme here, Jesus' way of peace is love. Love one another. That's the Father's command. That's the Father's way. Right? let's drop down to the end here, verse 31, right? Jesus says, "But I do as the Father has commanded me, so that the world may know that I love the Father." Right? Even here, Jesus understands his particular relationship now with the Father as one of love. And again, taking that love right to the cross. Because here again, in the cross, we have demonstrated, right? See again, as we disciples who are going to begin to see, in the cross is demonstrated the two ways of peace. How did the Roman authorities think they're going to, and the, how did the Roman authorities and the Jewish authorities think they're finally going to get some peace? Let's kill Jesus. If only, right? Once we kill Jesus, then we've got that, you know, revolutionary, insurrectionist, traitor, troublemaker out of our way, and we're all going to be at peace again. We look at the cross and say, no, the execution did not bring peace. Ironically, it was the love exhibited on the cross that brings peace. And so see, here again, we're back to Judas's question. We're back to that thing about, well, why do we see it and why doesn't the world see it? Well, how do you look at the cross? And what kind of peace do you think comes out of the cross? And for the disciple community, right, this opens it all up. Right? How do you make, and again, this is where Tara's going to come in, so I'm off the hook. But of course, one of the questions she's asking is, how do you make peace in your communities? Right? Now, again, right, I mean, I'm sure none of you are ever in these in situations like this in your congregation. There might be conflict, right? So if there's a conflict in your congregation, how do you make peace? Does someone have to be a winner and someone have to be a loser? Or are you going to be, you know, truly democratic about it and vote in majority rules? That's always a good way of making peace, because obviously the ones who lost the vote are always happy. It's like, oh, okay, majority rules, I'm fine, good, no problem, right? How do I mean? And you know, we can be silly about this, but we also know it's earnest, right? I mean, it is that sense. Again, with this notion, right? Is that political way of voting or whatever? And I mean, I'm not anti-democracy or anything like that, but John's pushing us a lot harder to say, remember, you're the disciple community. We're talking about love one another. I mean, does love one another always work out best to put things to democratic vote? I mean, it might be a way to elect, as a Canadian, I can say, well, it might be a way to elect the president, but I don't know about that. Chad seemed to be coming into the vocabulary, but all of that aside, right, is that the way we should be church? Or is there some other way where, you know, loving one another, all are brought into that decision and there is peace? Again, fortunately, we don't have to answer that question here, but ask that of Tara. That's her problem. Right? So there, but it is the serious problem. And just simply, our time is also a problem. Verse 30. Isn't this true? I will no longer talk much with you, but this one. The ruler of this world is coming. He has no power over me. That sense of he has no power over me. Again, I will translate that. In me, he does not have anything. And I want to put that in, you know, if this is good English, but I want to say that Jesus is saying, in me, in other words, the ruler of this world does not dwell in me. So if the ruler of this world doesn't dwell in me, that means all of this stuff that we so well, that we talked about, so doesn't dwell in Jesus either. Right? What dwells in Jesus? The Father and love. And so what Jesus is saying, and again, remember, he's going to the cross. But what he is telling us, even in going to the cross, that it is possible to dwell in love, even in the face of evil and destruction and death. It is possible. Now, that does not mean it is easy, right? Those are two very different things. But it is possible. And for us as disciple community, it is possible because we have the Paraclete dwelling in us, dwelling among us, and Jesus and the Father. And so again, if you will, with that team on our side, it also is possible. And again, that's the good news, the gifts that Jesus is giving us as he's calling us into community, into the ways of peace and love as possibilities in a world which thinks about peace very differently. Yeah, please. I think we're coming close to time, so if you need to go or whatever, feel free. Those who want to stay around and talk a little more are welcome to do so. Please.
Is it significant that the Holy Spirit, does the Holy Spirit come both personally and in community? And is it significant that, you know, Jesus is wherever two or three are gathered in my name there, and also...
I mean, that wherever two or three are gathered in my name, that's in Matthew, and I think that's, you know, Matthew's way or another way of talking about the same thing in terms of the Spirit dwelling among us.
But it's among us, yeah. More than...
It's, I think in the gospel, certainly in Paul, and I think this is what John is pushing, we're again talking about the Spirit as a communal phenomenon. It's dwelling amongst it. It's relational, and therefore there's an interaction. But of course, when that happens, we also internalize that and take it with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there can be a one-on-one.
I think there one would say, but even the one-on-one relationship with the Spirit is mediated through the community. I mean, if you will, even when you are at home reading the Bible by yourself and praying, and you say, well, there's no community. Of course there's a community there because... Right. The fact that you have a Bible and all of that, and that you have some sense, some insight of what this is all about, there has been a community at work there in all of that, and you are taking the effect of what that has been and right carrying that out in one at this place in an individual way. But again, I would say that's always communal and personal at the same time.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause there's a-